Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and senior market analyst here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. We're excited to have another special guest interview today. We're joined by James Nelson and Scott Singer from Avis & Young. Scott is principal and co-lead of Avis & Young's Tri-State Debt and Equity Finance team and a member of Avis & Young's U.S. Capital Markets Executive Committee. He's arranged more than $10 billion of construction and permanent debt and equity financing on behalf of many highly regarded New York City-based real estate family offices, developers, and institutional owners. James Nelson is principal and head of Avis & Young's Tri-State Investment Sales Group, where he leads a group of three dozen professionals in the sale of multifamily, office, development, and retail properties. James's team has closed over 150 sales valued at well above $2.5 billion. James, Scott, welcome. It's very good to have you guys with us. And Omar, I'll turn it over to you to kick us off.
Thank you. Scott, James, really excited to speak with you today. I think anybody really in the New York area and the tri-state area knows your names, whether because you've served them and worked with them on deals or probably competed with them. But I think that you're two known entities in New York in the greater tri-state area. And I think you have some amazing perspectives that I'm looking forward to hearing, as well as I think all of the listeners. But before we get in there, I'd love to allow our listeners to better understand about your background and really your path to Avis & Young. So James, do you want to share a little bit about what brought you to Avis & Young?
Sure. Thank you, Omar. And thank you, Cole. Great to be here with you and your audience, and really appreciate the warm intro. Although when I'm on a panel or a show with Scott with his $10 billion of transactions, it definitely is humbling. But no, it's
well, when you hear about his market share, I'll be humbled too.
But yeah, it's hard to believe. I've now been in the business for 25 years. So I started at a local firm that a lot of New Yorkers know, Massey Nackel. I was there for 17 years. And ultimately, we sold to Cushman & Wakefield. Had three great years there. And then I got a call with the opportunity to come over to Avis & Young to help build out their investment sales team. So for those of you that don't know Avis & Young, we're a full service real estate firm with over 120 offices around the world. And one of the most exciting things since I've been here is that when my friend Scott, when we asked if he wanted to join us, came over with his debt equity team.
It was great for us. And it was a call from James that started that. So we had been a boutique, the Singer & Bassett organization that my dad and I ran for about 25 years before that. And when James called and we got together, it was our last lunch before COVID. And then we restarted the conversation soon after that. And it's been now 2.5 years. So it's been very exciting to be here. It was one of the great reasons to come was to sit with James and his team. And what I've found is a dynamic, exciting global platform that's been wonderful for us.
That's fantastic. And there are, I would say, probably thousands of real estate firms and brokerages out there. There are very few that have 5,000 employees. I think, James, you just said 120 different offices sitting in 20 plus countries and really serving investors and owners and tenants in pretty much every way needed. But Avis & Young is in that kind of elite class. Scott, can you speak to some of Avis & Young's key differentiators? I'm sure James, that lunch with James probably was enough to give you conviction in joining, but what are some of those differentiators that the firm brings that really helped make that decision to join Avis & Young?
So starting with our perspective, we were a boutique where I was the youngest person on the team. And so there were a number of drivers for us to come, but being in a place that is dynamic, that's attractive to younger talent, and that has all of those services lined. Really, it's allowed me to activate my relationships in that. So we have investment sales and leasing and valuation, and sorry for the valuation, but project management and property management. And to be able to provide that full service and to be in the info flow in that way is really was a differentiator for us as opposed to boutique. On the other hand, we don't have 100,000 employees. And so here now I have direct personal relationships with the heads of our offices all over the country, with our CEO, with the people who are running our new business in Vietnam, and the head of our European markets in Poland. And that ability to have enormous resources and yet personal, real relationships with the decision makers is really key.
And Scott, if I could just add one more thing as well, just the way that Avis & Young's ownership structure is a little different. So we're a principally owned company. So Scott and I are two of about 750 owners of the company. And so it's a much different experience than being at a big publicly traded shop. You have stakeholders here at the table. And my experience is that we'll go out of each other's way to help clients out. We also, you know, at some of the bigger firms, sometimes there's not a sharing of the information, whereas we're all tapped into one database. So that's also served us really well.
And that was a major driver for me with James and his team to sit here and to come to a place where I spent my entire career and my family beyond that in New York real estate finance, but to have the ability to integrate with James's team and with the other teams, both here in New York and around the country, going back to why did we come? Those were really important reasons for us. And it's happening, which is exciting.
Fantastic. And James, my understanding is that you've set up your org to be better aligned with that principal structure. Can you speak to how your current team structure aligns with that principal orientation as opposed to how other brokerages might not have as much of that?
Sure. So there's one Tri-State Investment sales team here. So we don't have a bunch of different sales brokers who are essentially competing with each other. We work as one group together. We meet every morning. We go around the table. And that also means that when we close a deal that all salespeople are compensated on every transaction. And so I think what that does is that it really fosters collaboration that you might not see elsewhere. And I think that it's important to align culture with compensation. And I think we've really solved for that.
And I could also see that as being a huge motivator to junior talent to want to stay with the org and to really want to grow there. Have you seen any, and I know this is maybe a question we didn't really practice in the prep.
No, but, I love the question and I'm glad you asked because look, going in and being a salesperson full commission can be really daunting. Now, a lot of the ways that, and certainly the way that I got into the business is you start as a sales associate working for a senior broker, or you can start as an analyst, but both tracks work. But then when it's time for you to kind of launch off on your own, suddenly, you know, it's full commission. And for some people, that's exciting and saying, hey, I'm willing to put everything on the line. But I think it's much easier for someone to grow with a team and know that day one, they're tapped in to this mature business line that has transactions that they can work on. And also, I think it helps them when they identify potential business that they know they have a deep bench behind them to help bring in that assignment and really serve the client. So we think the structure works really well. And I think Scott's group isn't too dissimilar with the way they're set up.
Yeah, and we see the benefit, and I see the benefit in hearing how, as I walk up and down the aisles and hear James's team talking, it's a lot of we. And as we go to them for either questions about what they're doing, or just now we got a call that I haven't even mentioned to you about a client that we share, and I knew I could go to anyone on the team and they'd have information and knowledge to be able to get that for me. So we're emulating in lots of ways what I've seen James do in terms of team structure and media presence and others. You're doing things well.
And so, Scott, I take that your team is structured similarly, or?
Yeah, well, our team is smaller. So we're a dozen people. And I think what we share is a fierce advocacy for our clients, knowing what side of the table we're on, but then also building strong relationships with the other side of the table. So for us, it translates into everyone on our team. We sit together daily or almost daily, and we are sharing information, and we are functioning, again, as one team out there to execute for our clients. And part of executing is the other side of the table. So we have built relationships with capital, debt, and equity of all different types. And the sharing that we have as a team is those relationships and those interactions as well, and getting that information around our whole team on an immediate basis is something that we've worked hard to do over the years, and so that we can get the benefit. Whoever from our team is on a call, the information gets out there widely. And that's also translated for both of us beyond just New York, but to the other Avis and teams in our disciplines.
And I could see that information sharing being so critical, especially in the last two to three years when, you know, so much has changed and it's changing quite quickly. Even if you look at like the rate environment, we haven't seen the changes that people wanted to see, but the expectations are changing, which then that flows through to pretty much every deal or would be deal. So I guess, what are some of the big changes you have seen that you have had to digest and that you've had to really bring the team together to work on recently?
I think for us, one approach we've taken to the other side of the table, to the capital source, is to have a wide berth of relationships so that when we never want to be in a situation where the world changes in some way and suddenly we don't know who to talk to. And so in this case, if it was a pullback in regional banks, we've always gone out with our deals. I mean, we follow our clients, what our clients are open to. But in general, when we do a wide distribution of a deal, it goes to a variety of different sources. So even in times when CMBS lenders were highly likely to be the winner of a transaction, we'd like to put it in front of insurance companies and in front of banks as well. And when the CMBS market, let's say, is slower, and we know that it's highly likely an insurance company is going to win a deal, well, we still wanted to get the deal in front of the CMBS lenders so that when the world changes, we never want to be in a position where we go to a lender with a deal and they say, oh, now you remember us. Where have you been for the last few years? And so there's been a lot of that volatility over the last couple of years. So that's how I see it maybe playing out the most.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my answer to that question would be that, and now that Scott and I have seen a couple of these cycles, no two are exactly the same.
I've seen maybe one or two more than him.
But it's, I think, having that team that you can bounce ideas off of, certainly relationships that Scott has on the lender side. We're getting into a lot of these situations, and sometimes we have clients who are under pressure with the lender. And so if we can come with a solution that works for everybody, I think it really works well. But you certainly have to be creative, I think, also in this market to get things done. And I think also in many cases, it's finding that contrarian, that outlier buyer. I mean, let's face it, last year, sales volume was cut in half in New York year over year from 22 to 23. I think nationally, I think the drop off was even steeper. And a lot of that was because a lot of the institutions were just on the sidelines. Once rates started going up, middle of 22, you started seeing buyers and sellers alike just going to the sidelines saying, hey, we don't know where this thing's going. Obviously, buyers are hoping that pricing's moving in their favor and there'll be more opportunities that come. And sellers are hoping that they're going to get a rate cut or two and things will improve. But as a result, you've got a lot of known buyers, investors on the sidelines. And that's why we had to be, when we're out representing owners to sell their property, we had to be all the more proactive to go and find those outlier buyers. Last year, I think we closed at least five or six transactions with Japanese buyers. And that's the nice thing about New York is we can get a lot of foreign appetite as well, though we're starting to see that across the country as well.
Do you think that foreign appetite was a blip, or do you see that continuing?
No, it's been pretty consistent over the years. Going back to the last peak of the market, 2015, 2016, China was about a third of the foreign interest here in New York. And that also constituted a lot of the large trophy assignments. And now they've certainly scaled back. But that's the great thing about New York and some of these gateway cities is you have foreign capital coming in from all over the world. I don't think it's just this certain point in time. I think the important thing is you have to be out there to find out where is the capital flowing from at present, because it does change. In addition to the Japanese, we've seen a lot of German capital flow in, Korean. So it's just being out there day in and day out.
Yeah, and absolutely. As central banks, I think, start to diverge, right? Because we're seeing that certain banks are, I think, further along in terms of taking those next steps in their monetary policy that ultimately has implications for really FX fluctuations. And I could see that really going into a known market in a very robust economy, such as the U.S., could be a real safe haven for foreign capital. And I know that's only part of your coverage and part of your area, but New York is a pretty phenomenal market to be looking at for real estate. But I guess shifting and diving in a little bit deeper into kind of some of the real estate trends, James, do you mind highlighting some of the recent market trends that you're seeing, whether it's across multifamily, retail, office, development, and any of the submarkets that have caught your attention?
Sure. And I know you have a national, if not a global audience, so I won't get too specific into New York housing. First of all, because we could probably spend a whole hour just talking about what's taking place. But I think just big picture, because it does signify a trend that's happening across the country, which is rent reform, rent regulation. So New York State did just pass a whole slew of legislation in their housing package, which, among other things, has established what they're calling good cause eviction, which caps the amount that you can renew an existing tenant for. Of course, there are some exclusions for newer buildings, certain rent levels, but now in New York, you have to give most fair market tenants the ability to renew at the lesser of 10% or CPI plus 5%. So modeled on the California limits at this point. So you do see this trend where a lot of states are trying to solve for this type of rent reform, fear that rents are spiraling out of control. My belief is the answer to this is to create more housing, which New York has not done an amazing job of last year. In a city where our mayor said we need 500,000 new housing units, there was only permits for 10,000 new units. Hopefully, what Albany passed will help get development moving again, because there was a bunch of tax subsidies now that were passed, replacing the old 421A with new abatements for new construction. So that's good. And then on top of it, proposals, abatements to incentivize office to rental, office to residential conversions. That's certainly a trend that I'm sure you all have been hearing about across the country. A little easier said than done. On one hand, here in New York, we have 20% availability. That equates to about 100 million square feet of available office space. I just said we need 500,000 housing units. So it would seem pretty easy to think, why don't we just convert it all? But obviously, you need zoning, the floor plates have to work, or at least the economics have to work. So, you know, those are some of the things that government is trying to incentivize to happen. As far as trends, quickly, I would just say it's been really interesting to watch how office and retail, in many cases, has been bought up by companies, taking advantage, capitalizing this market. So Prada buys their property on Fifth Avenue for $800 million, not to be outdone by Prada, who comes in for over $900 million. So these are pretty sizable investments, and I think also a great vote of confidence for New York.
And I guess in terms of on the financing side, Scott, I think all eyes have been on not only the 5-year and the 10-year, but how does that translate into New York's market? Do you think that is there still been appetite? I know NYCB caught some kind of like negative press, and there's, I would say, the financing in New York at the national level of media attention has not been the best. But are there any trends that you could call out that are a little bit more than just the headline?
I think it's very important to understand we're not in a liquidity crisis. Right, the only liquidity crisis in my career was at the very beginning in the early 90s. And in the early 90s, when I joined the business, there was the brokers in the shop had an assignment over the weekend to come up with a list of any lenders who would lend on anything. And I still have the list. It's 2 pages long and it's triple spaced in big font.
How many of those banks are still around?
Well, most of them.
Oh, really?
Well, actually, mergers, yes, because it was groups that any group that could stay in the market at that point has real staying power. And there are some banks who we still do business with. But that was a liquidity crisis. There's been no time since then when the real challenge was the availability of capital. I think that the challenge that we have now is a disconnect between the counterparties in transactions, whether it's buyer and seller, or we see it a lot now in equity investors who are seeing opportunities to make preferred equity investments. And we see it in development where between the yield on cost that is desired by the capital sources. The capital's there and it wants to get out. And you've seen some transactions where they've gone to market, they've been very attractive. There's a lot of players that want to participate, whether it's lenders for us or buyers for the investment sales deals. But even the deals where there's substantial amount of competition, the bidding ends at a level has not resulted in easy money, let's say, from our perspective. And so we are driving competition and we're driving down spreads on deals that a lot of lenders want. But if we were trying to drive proceeds very high, that wouldn't necessarily happen. I think that's a result of the higher cost overall in the market. I think that one trend that I think is wrong is when I hear people say, well, you know, it's hard to transact at these all-time high rates. We are not at all-time high rates. The average 10-year treasury rate over the last 60 years is over 4.75%, right? And we're at the risk of not having looked at it in the last couple hours, in the 4.5% range. So we're at a treasury rate that's below the long-term average. From spreads perspective, the spreads in the market now, let's say the absolute lowest spread available for any market, any deal now is probably 120. There's not a lot of that money around. Again, from a historical perspective, that's not the all-time low, but it's pretty attractive. And so we're in a process of re-education of the market to remember that the extraordinarily low pricing of the last few years was not normal. And I think that while the Fed was increasing rates on a weekly basis, it felt like it was very hard to transact because the question was, how bad would it get? And then earlier this year, when the expectation was that there were going to be 6 rate cuts this year, it was hard to transact because it was, let's wait because hopefully rates are going to be a lot better. And I think that the evolution in the last few weeks has been positive, certainly for the brokerage community, because we thrive on transactions, is that expectation that suddenly really low rates were going to come again is out the window. And so there's a need that I see really all market participants looking at it and saying, okay, I'm in the business to transact. I have these things I need to do. It's unlikely there's going to be massive positive change. How do I get deals done?
I love that. If the base rates don't necessarily move and the expectation is shifted to something that is probably more reflective of reality, of we're no longer expecting 6 rate cuts, and so people aren't holding back because they think that there might be cheaper financing in the near term, and the spreads have still a bit more room. Do you see spreads compressing through the end of the year, or do you think even just a stabilization of the spread would be beneficial to transaction activity and just going along with this realization that you don't have to wait for the Fed to cut before actually transacting?
I don't see a push towards a substantial decrease in pricing coming. And so will there be some compression in spreads in the more out of favor properties or markets? Maybe some, but I don't see it. And I think that the counsel that we've generally given borrowers who ask, should I wait, has been, and this has been in all types of markets, is there financing now that works for you and that is aligned with the profile of the investment for you and with your plan and with your horizon? And if so, it seems to make sense to stay in the role as being a real estate operator and developer, not an interest rate player. And so there's a slide that we show a lot that is the forward rate curve of 5 and 10-year treasuries. And I generally show it to great surprise, and this was even more of a factor. So now we're mid-May, so I don't know when this will air. In mid-May, we're a few weeks after the Fed has made it clear they're not going to cut. But a few weeks ago before that happened, when there was the expectation of cuts, the forward curve still showed 5 and 10-year treasuries really not dropping at all, maybe 25 basis points for a short period of time, and then a trend upward for the next 10 years. And so that was always surprising. That's been surprising to any group that I've shown it to. And the point that I've made is I don't forecast rates going forward. But the group that, what's the forward curve? It shows the traders who trade on treasuries, who make their living by betting on where treasuries are going. That's the sum of all the bets that they're making now. And that expectation among those people is that index rates are not dropping. The lowest spread I did in my whole career was 12.5 basis points over swaps, which was 62 basis points over treasuries. And that was in the hottest market there's probably ever going to be in the end of 2006, 2007. We're not that far off of that if the cheapest spreads now are only 55 basis points above that. With the uncertainty that exists in the world in so many different ways, including the election, for someone who is going to want to execute a transaction in the next 6 to 12 months, if it works now, are suggesting is to do it. And it's self-serving, but I think that it's also good advice. And that's really where our focus is. How can we best serve our clients? And it's by finding the deals that can get done now and getting them to get to the finish line.
Omar, I would certainly agree with that. And I have one more thing that I think is an important component to add, because pricing is obviously a very important part of the equation, but the amount of leverage is also what's really creating a lot of challenges. So it's not just for borrowers who are seeing that their rates are going up, but it's the amount of proceeds. And so what's creating a lot of sales opportunities for us right now, and frankly, distress, is this massive deleveraging where the borrower is going for the refi. And yes, there's capital available and the rate's going to be more expensive. But the real challenge for a lot of them is you got to cash in if you want that refinance. And a lot of borrowers either do not have the ability or the desire to do that. So we're seeing situations that have equity in the deal, but they don't have the ability to pay down and refinance. We actually just closed a $60 million transaction, a portfolio in Greenwich Village, Chelsea, and Soho. This was over 40-year ownership. And again, they went to try to go refinance, and the bank said, you got to pay the mortgage down. They said, hey, after all these decades, we're not about to issue a capital call.
Yeah.
So they ended up selling it. So, and again, those are the lucky, in air quotes, borrowers. There's many situations, not any of Scott's clients, but many who are in over their heads and they're upside down. And back in 2008, 2009, I was really busy with loan sales representing the big banks. They seem to have gotten a lot smarter this go around, although offices will push that to the side, that there's certainly some examples of some note sales there. But I think what we're more seeing today is a lot of these short sales where lenders and borrowers are working together saying, hey, let's run a fully transparent process, a conventional marketing process where we don't have to, let's save the legal bills. Let's save this long drawn out foreclosure where you drag the property through the mud. And frankly, a lot of these borrowers don't want their names in the headlines either. Let's just work together and do a sale. And if we can recoup some of the equity, great. But if not, the lender sees all the offers on the table and is in a better position if they want to go ahead with that short sale.
Yeah, I think one of the services that James's team has been doing over the last year is providing BOVs to lenders, for example. And he's really been educating that market so that those lenders, and the result is those lenders being willing to do the short sales, not out of desperation, but out of understanding the reality of the value that exists. We've been working hard to find the ways that we can collaborate. And that's one where I think there are a couple in there where that's been, A, that's our relationships with lenders and me feeling very confident in recommending James's team, that I don't think there's anyone who has a better feel for the market and for where valuation is now. And then on the other hand, we can approach borrowers together and offer a variety of solutions that ranges from everything to a refinancing if the sizing works, to a recapitalization that sort of both of us with different sets of capital that we, his capital that he knows are operators, my capital that I focus on are money partners, investors, let's say, and then all the way down to the sales transactions as well. So it's a nice collaboration there that I think is benefiting all sides of the transaction. It's really win-win.
Absolutely. Especially, I think it's a challenging market environment. So that I think that collaboration within the firm is excellent because it probably leads to the ideal outcome for the client. But James,
that's what we're focused on. Yeah. Absolutely. It really is. And I think that's one place where this firm from the very top all the way through is focused on finding that the best executions for the client. And I think we all focus on who are we representing and how can we do best for them, by them.
Fantastic. And just hopping back, James, it sounds like a lot of the recent transactions have been driven by this kind of the need, right? Do you see that shifting at all? If, for example, if rates stay at these kind of long-term historical normal levels and we don't go back to this free or easy money, do you think that trend of transactions being driven predominantly by need is going to continue? Or are we mostly through the need portion of the market that would need to transact?
Yeah, I wish I could say that we're through the majority of those situations, but I believe that, there's still about $1.5 trillion of debt coming due in the next 5 years. And it gets very specific. What you don't want to do is make generalizations about the whole market. And you hear all these panels say, oh, you can't get any financing for an office deal. Scott, how many office deals have you financed in the last year or two? I mean, substantial amount.
We're getting them done. Now, challenging at micro. Happily, a lot of those conversations and a lot of what we see in the press is macro. But we live in a micro world where one transaction at a time, can we get it done? And I think that even last year, in the worst environment that I've seen in 30 years for financing office buildings, we got several done. We closed 4 office building loans last year. Is that a volume I'd brag about in any other year? No, but we're very proud of it. On the other hand, our clients get a lot of the credit because these were very low leverage transactions where they have great discipline over time. The change is that last year, it was practically impossible to finance any office building at anything other than ridiculously low leverage. And that's not the case now. Still very challenging from a macro environment. Office has a lot of challenges, but at the micro level, there are far more transactions that can get done with decently priced and sized.
Yeah. So Omar, you can tell it gets really specific to what kind of asset, where is it, what's the lease up. If we're talking about multifamily here with rent regulation, yeah, it's going to be challenging for a while because you have the number two, the formerly number two lender completely out of business with Signature, and New York community likely with their hands tied in many cases. So, you know, that there's a lot of debt coming due for these rent-regulated apartments. And I think, especially a lot of these regional banks, there's a lot of scrutiny today. There are going to be some challenging times ahead of us for sure. And that's why, again, one of the earlier things I said, creativity. I mean, we're always, when we look at a situation, can the loan be assumed? Are there other options? Is there seller financing? These are ways that we're trying to get things done.
And now just shifting a little bit away from the market specific commentary. Both of you are highly involved in the industry. So even outside of your day jobs, you're involved in industry groups, either representing the industry to the broader economy and to, I would say, regulators and the local municipalities. But also, I know you're involved in training up the next generation, passing along with a thought leadership and teachings and insights. Scott, can you speak to your involvement with REBNY, what REBNY is, as well as how you're involved?
Sure. So REBNY is the Real Estate Board of New York, and it's a trade organization that represents owners and professionals in New York real estate. I'm pretty sure James and I met on a board that we served on a board together there, and I think it might be where we first met. And it's been a really important part of my career, and it's especially important now because there is this misunderstanding of real estate owners and the real estate development community as the enemy or the oppressor in this. And whereas the reality is that the enormous amount of good that the real estate industry does for every community is the real story. And I think that REBNY, as a trade organization representing us as brokers and representing the developers and being out front in pushing the arguments that make sense for moving communities forward, it's been a very important organization for both of us, and one that we encourage all of the younger people who work with us to get involved in. It's also a great place to network. We've met friends, we've met clients, we've met competitors, we've met collaborators, and really a wonderful, an important organization now, especially for New York.
And I would just add to that how important it is. This is an in-person business, and it's great that we can deliver content to so many people through the podcast forum. But I think to have these in-person organizations, events. So in addition to being part of REBNY, I now chair the Young Men's and Women's Real Estate Association, which was born out of REBNY. And there's a lot of great organizations that put together events as well, where young professionals can show up and meet people. And that's probably the number one question I always get is career advice. How do I find my next job? And it can be really challenging when you're out there just trying to link in with people or sending cold emails. We just hired for a junior analyst position and we had 400 applications. Now, this is maybe it's a sign of the times. I know when I graduated from Colgate, I went to Massey Knackle, there was only two people who applied for the job and I was supposedly their second pick. So I would have not made it in the business today. The point is what I tell people is, look, this is an in-person job. You need to show up. And if you just graduated from college, you're looking for the next opportunity, go to one of these industry breakfasts. And I said, I know it's uncomfortable. No one likes going to a room where you show up and you don't know anyone. But I guarantee if you go up to five people and you say, I just graduated college, I'm looking to get into the real estate business, can you tell me a little bit about how you got started and any advice? Who's not going to, you know, try to be helpful? And by the way, if they're not, then move on. That person's not worth dealing with anyways. But the majority of people are going to tell you the story and maybe they don't have a job for you, but they might point you in the right direction and say, well, hey, have you tried this? Have you tried that? So I think it's just an extension, but it's great that Rebney offers these in-person forums to come in and meet people, certainly Young Men's and Women's Real Estate Association. And there's a lot of other incredible organizations that can really help with that piece.
Yeah, that's really good advice. It's funny, I've been doing some mentoring through a Cornell program, the Cornell Real Estate Program, and partly I use it as an excuse to get up to campus because my kids are there. But the first advice that I give with that question is develop your networks, and your networks are all around you. They say, I don't have a network yet. And I say, yes, and often we do it in a group. And I say, just look around. Look at the people in the room. Who are the people who live in your dorm? Who did you grow up with? And some of them have said, I really want to get started as a developer, but how do you get the capital for your first deal? And I say, it's going to come from someone you already know. So think about everyone who you know, and you can't tell just by being in the same room with them whose parents have money, who's connected to someone else, who's going to make a lot of money in their first job. But those people who have the personal connection with you, start with them and then build out from there. And I think that it's great advice, which I'm going to use as far as going to a breakfast. If you're willing to put yourself out there, people respect that. And it's hard. And I tell the story that if you hear something that you don't understand, ask about it. And then I started out and I would say, well, I've only been in the business for 6 weeks. Can you explain this? And then it's 2 years. And then when I got to 10 years, I just stopped saying, I've only been in the business for 10 years. But still, I hear things all the time that I need to ask about, and you have to be willing to do it. But most people respect it. And similar to what James said, if someone gives you a hard time for that, move on. Or they probably don't know the answer.
I've got to make a plug for my podcast right now, The Insider's Edge to Real Estate Investing, because one of my favorite episodes was Jordan Vogel, who co-founded Benchmark. And for those of you aspiring investors listening to this show, you probably should have a disclaimer before listening to this episode. But Jordan went hard on a contract, put up basically $600,000, half of it being pretty much every cent he had. And just what you said, started going through his network and saying, okay, who did I go to school with? Who did I work with? Family, friends, and literally went and raised the money he needed to close on that first deal that propelled him. I mean, now well over 100 deals later. So I think I haven't been sued by Nike yet for that episode, but we called it Just Do It. Because I think a lot of people, the hesitance is, okay, I'm not ready. And he just said, you know, at some point you got to jump in. So that one's definitely worth a listen.
And we have a young woman on our team who was very clear, just has a great personality and who we knew would be able to capture clients and pushing her over the edge to make that first call. And she loves it. And the excitement that she's gotten out of those calls back and the meetings and all that. But it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's definitely hard.
And so, James, do you mind talking a little bit about the Insider's Edge to Real Estate Investing? I know you just worked it in on the last thoughts, but I know it's a podcast.
That's the podcast. Yeah. There's also the book. I'm trying to remember now what came first. It was really the podcast that started in the middle of 2020. We're all at home. COVID, is this the end of the world? And thinking, okay, for once in my career, I finally have some free time. You know, what do I want to do with this? And I found that, oh, wow, there's this medium called Zoom and you can, or now I guess it's trying to look at what platform we're on right now, but certainly there's a lot of options now. But the idea was, wow, I can actually have conversations with people. We can record them and we can share them. And I said, wow. And at the time I wasn't even a podcast listener myself. Now I'm a voracious consumer of podcasts as well, including this one. But then out of that came the book, because for 20 plus years, people have asked me, James, what's the book that teaches you how to invest in real estate? And what I found was that there's a lot of the kind of rich dad, poor dad, how to flip homes. And it can be a great way to get started. But to talk about what we do and how to do a serious commercial real estate transaction, not the textbooks that are in the master's program, I wanted something that was really practical, where you could read this book and say, okay, I understand how this works. And Scott was super helpful in the chapter that we covered the capital stack and debt equity. So that's been an amazing thing. Was fortunate, was ranked a Wall Street Journal bestseller. So that was the goal, to get it out there to the masses. And I get a ton of positive feedback from it now.
Yeah, I think the stories that are in there, it reminds me of Larry Silverstein's NYU course that he taught forever. And it was basically a series of guest speakers. And this was a Tuesday night course that I think everyone who started in the real estate business between the 1970s and probably 2010 at least went and heard. And it gave you access to the active players in the business and what they were doing and how they made it. And I think the book is really well the successor to that tradition. It's an entertaining way to learn some really important information.
As we're going through this phase of the cycle, do you think there'll be a round two or a second volume?
Hopefully you won't have enough time.
I will say that I had a tremendous amount of help with the book. First of all, I have an incredible writing partner, Rachel Hartman, who I still collaborate with, and a great agent and publishing team. So yeah, it is possible. The thing is, you want Insider's Edge to real estate investing is, I hope, really evergreen. What I didn't want it to be is super timely, where within 6 months it's stale. Now, what's amazing, I think so far it stood the test of time. This was before rates started going up. But like, for example, one of the chapters in the book is on sellers' motivation and why it is so important when you're looking for a great opportunity to find out, why is someone selling? It would shock you how rarely people ask me, James, why is your client selling? So something like that is incredibly important right now. Are there other books? I mean, I've thought about, could there be the Insider's Edge series? I definitely like to talk about the sales process and how to market and how to get top price. I think that could be interesting. I'm also very interested in distressed investing right now. So that's definitely a lot more timely. If I was going to do that, we'd have to jump on that right away. Again, hopefully that would stand the test of time. So, you know, there's a lot of topics and things that interest me if time was no object. But at the end of the day, I have the same 24 hours a day that everyone else has.
But somehow he gets three times as much time.
On the subject of having not enough time in the day, we are coming to the end of our interview with you guys. And we always like to ask our guests one question. And so you can take this, you know, James or Scott first. But we like to ask folks that if you could snap your fingers and have any change come to the industry right now, what would that be? We've gotten all kinds of stuff, but I want to pose that question to you guys. Any change to the industry to come true, what would it be?
I would change every deal that's currently underwriting to a 6 yield on cost to a 7. I could place $1 billion of equity in about 30 minutes if all these 6% deals were penciling out a little bit better.
And I would say, and maybe this would tap into a future book, but one of the reasons why it's called the Insider's Edge to real estate investing is I really do believe that you can gain the inside edge, because real estate is really an inefficient marketplace, which is pretty wild. You would think, okay, I've been doing this for 25 years. I would say the way properties are sold in large part are still done the same way. Now, there's incredible companies like yours that have offered a lot of tools, a lot of technology, a lot of efficiencies. You all have perfected Argus. And yet the way things are sold is still a lot of the product trades off market. So the fact that 60% of trades in the U.S. still sell without a major brokerage firm is pretty wild to me. So I don't know. Your question is, James, what would you change? So if you change that, let's say if we could make real estate a marketplace, a really efficient marketplace, that would be pretty amazing, because then real estate would become more liquid. You could buy, sell. Maybe I'd be out of a job then.
That's what I would say.
And then you'd lose this ability really to gain that advantage and outperform the market. So again, maybe this is a topic for a future book, but it's just, it does amaze me that with all this technology and all this ability, that a lot of the times properties still trade without a broker, or maybe if there is even a broker, that a lot of brokers don't use the tools that are out there to maximize exposure and send it out to the whole world and do things like this. So I don't know if that answers your question, but maybe some food for thought, so to speak.
I think I'd push back on that only to say that, and part of this comes from, I know what we do and from seeing how you do it, that I don't think commercial real estate is not a commodity. And even within the CMBS market, where the idea is to commoditize it, there is still great differentiation that occurs when you have professionals who have experience and ingenuity and creativity and knowledge. And that really goes to James's point, which is if 60% of the market is missing out on that, that's a real opportunity.
Thank you guys for joining us. I think that is all the time we've got today, but it's been a nice, insightful conversation, and I really appreciate it. But thank you guys so much. And Omar, I will speak with you on another episode of CRE Exchange very soon. Y'all have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks,
you
too. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.